So today, as I said on Tuesday, we are going to present, you know, how functional integral quantization, so the quantization for bypass integral methods for a quantum field, the free scalar field, leads to an easy way to do calculation and to obtain results that which you have already obtained by canonical quantization. So we are not going to introduce new physics, but we are going to see how it's a useful tool. So first, in fact, I'd like just to give a non-answer to a question I had during the last lecture, which was, how do you make the connection between canonical quantization and so building up state of the field associated with, you know, using creation and annihilation operator, and the object that I called in a loose way, a field phi, in using canonical quantization, using path integral or functional integral quantization. I'm not going to give an answer, but I will tell you that in fact I thought a little bit and looked at news. In fact, the connection between this and the creation and annihilation operator of the mode, in fact, if you really want to understand that in a qualitative way, you have to use the notion of coherent states, and which is a very important notion in both quantum physics and in quantum theory. And I don't know if you have heard about coherent states already. That's something you will meet in more advanced course, I'm sure, if you have not heard about it. It's something that has been basically in physics introduced by, I think it was Heisenberg or Schrödinger for the harmonic oscillator, where you had the creation and alienation, you know, operators for just energy levels of the harmonic oscillator, but that's a very important feature. And I might, if I have time, speak about coherent state when I will be doing with a functional integral method for fermions. And I think Maite has already said some word about that. But so for the moment, that's all what I'm able to say about relation, but important mathematical concept behind this coherent state. Okay, so now let's go back to the aim of this course. I'm going to present, see how you recover the propagator of the free field, that's the Feynman propagator that we have been studying and constructing in QFT1 using functional integration method. So in order to do that, so we want to compute, some, we want the object, which is basically the matrix element between matrix vacuum, so the vacuum expectation value of an object, which in theory is just time order products, the product of two fields, located at different point in different events, so point in space time, where x is let's call it x1, x2, okay? Where x1 is t1, x1, and x2 is t2, x2 in space time. Okay, so that's what's called the Feynman propagator of x1. Okay, so, well, we have seen from the general rule of path, yes?
I'm still not understanding very well the physical meaning of that. Like, I know that it's like the probability amplitude from going to the vacuum to the vacuum.
Yes.
Like, but I don't know if it's like interacting in two points.
No, but I will see, but I think you have seen that in the QFT1 course. Basically, the phi hat operator in the canonical formulation, the phi hat is something, it's of course you have a momenta, you have x, but that's basically a combination of creation and annihilation operator, where the creation and annihilation operator creates modes with momentum k and you sum over all the momenta. So basically, when you apply a phi operator on the vacuum, you cannot, well, it's A, not A plus A, A dagger, it's A. You cannot annihilate, you cannot destroy a particle, so this is zero. And here you can only create one particle. Okay. So then the particles propagate. Time, remember that we have this picture, which is that you have time. So here is x1 if you want, here is x1. Here is x2. So you create a particle at located at point x1 at time t1. Then this particle propagates, and then you apply the operator phi dagger at point x2. So this component creates a second particle. But then a two particle states, the scalar product of the two particle state with the zero particle state is zero, orthogonal. And this annihilates the particle. And then you get the vacuum state and the scalar product is one. So basically this object is more or less the probability, the quantum probability amplitudes to create a particle there, annihilate there. And the fact that you sandwich between the vacuum means that you have only one particle, zero particle here, zero particle here, one particle in this time slice. So that's the physical interpretation. Okay. I'm right? Yeah. Okay. Okay, so now let's go back to what we want to do. Okay, so this is real time. So we'll go back to that later. But I'm going to do the calculation in Euclidean time because first it's simpler, no I epsilon. For me, I dislike I epsilon. But of course, they are very important for physics and for just understanding what causality is. So I'm going to do the calculation in Euclidean time. And go back to real time later. And another reason is that using Euclidean time is a nice way to project on the vacuum. So that's also important to project on the vacuum. Because remember, so I'm going to consider this system, the quantum field, in Euclidean time. So here I have T Euclidean. Here I have a space, and I'm going to use periodic boundary condition. So it means that in fact, in the Euclidean time direction, the space-time is a cylinder. And the reason is the following. That's because if you have a periodic time with period p, then you have seen that when you want to compute using path integral methods, using this method, with this periodic boundary, what you are considering is, if you want to consider some operator, so I consider some observable, physical observable A, that's a product of operator, then by path integral, of a functional integral, if you compute exponential minus 1 over h bar s Euclidean of phi, and you insert the function of the fields that correspond to this quantum observable, then what you are computing, and with periodic TE with period p, what we are computing, in fact, is the vacuum expectation, the expectation value of the operator A in a Gibbs state with temperature 1 over kBT equals the period divided by h bar. Because remember, P is time. So which means that what we are computing is the sum over the energy eigenstates of our system. Matrix elements N, E, N, where A is the operator, with exponential minus P over h bar times the energy of the states, where N is an energy eigenstates. Okay. And so basically this is a part, some kind of partition function of a system where you have inserted an operator A in your path interval. Okay, it's valid for quantum mechanics, it's valid for quantum field theory. But of course, when you compute the expectation value in a Gibbs state of some operator, you have to divide by the partition function. N. Okay? And the partition function is just the same quantity without matrix element. So it's just in a path integral, the same period TE equal P, P phi exponential minus 1 over h bar SE of phi. So you see that the ratio of two path integrals, ratio, is equal to the expectation value of A hat at temperature T, given by this very important relation between the period and the temperature. Yes?
Why do we assume Euclidean time is periodic?
Why?
Why do we assume Euclidean time is periodic?
Because I've explained in last lecture that, I think, did I? That in order to compute this kind of quantity, you take a trace, you see, you sum over n. So you said that the initial condition in your path integral is the same as the final condition in the path integral, and you sum over all initial conditions. So space-time, instead of considering path integrals, it goes like that. You consider histories of your system, which goes like that. And this is as admissible as this one. So it's periodic. So this is a general relation that I express that periodic Euclidean time equal temperature. Well, by through this relation, so the periodicity is the inverse of the time. Okay. And so you see immediately from this relation that if you want to select the ground state, the state with minimal energy, all what you have to do is to take the limit of the period going to infinity. So to select ground state matrix element, you take the limit where P goes to infinity, which is equivalent to take the limit where the temperature goes to zero. So you start from a system quantized in periodic Euclidean time, and you take the limit when the period goes to infinity. So basically, you recover your system in infinite Euclidean time. And automatically, you select vacuum to vacuum matrix element operators. So that's what I'm going to show. Okay. So. Okay, so now let's go back to the, yes?
So why is the path integral equal to the sum over Gibbs?
Is the sum? Why is the path integral given by this object? That's simply because go back to a quantum mechanical system particle, which is the simplest example. Then, if you compute sum over the energy eigenstate of n, a n, e minus p over h bar e n. Well, since those are energy eigenstates, you can put this inside that by saying that this is sum over n over n, a e minus p over h bar times the Hamiltonian. So these are operators times n. So this object is a trace of an operator a times the exponential of the Hamiltonian. And now, this is a trace. So I can re-express this as a trace in position space. So this is same thing, an integral dq. Q a hat minus p over h bar h hat of q. And this object, we know how to write it in terms of a path integral. We know that this is integral. So this is integral over dq. And then integral over some path integral over the position of my particle, exponential minus 1 over h bar the Euclidean action of the history, times the function a of q, which corresponds to the observable here, okay, with initial and final conditions, which are equal. And then you can just reincorporate this into a path integral with this is equivalent to state by a condition q of 0 is equal to q of p, where p is the Euclidean period. So that's it. So that's what I did last time, just without an observable, but it works too for an observable. Okay, so that's a general. And of course, this argument extends to QFT, which is just a very general argument. Okay. Okay, so now let's go back to the Gaussian, to the free field. Free scalar field. So the free scalar field in the path integral formulation, as well as in the classical formulation, is described by a phi field phi, which depends on the vector x, where x is Euclidean time x. So I'm dealing with the Euclidean space time. Okay. And we know that the action ST of phi is just the integral over by Euclidean spacetime of 1 half of d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared, where d mu, where this is x0 to xd minus 1. So the indices mu goes from 0 to d minus 1. So the label is the component of a d-dimensional vector. And d mu is just the usual derivative with respect to the component mu of x. Okay. Okay, so what we want to compute here, what we want to compute is the expectation value of phi of x1, phi of x2 for the Euclidean theory. Where we have our space So now I'm going to, this is T Euclidean, this is space, and this is space, and this is, you have some point x1 here, and some point x2. Okay? So, general rules. This expectation value is the ratio of a functional integral, including this observable, divided by this functional integral without including this observable. So this is integral d of phi, phi of x1, phi of x2, exponential of minus 1 over h bar se of phi, divided by integral over d phi, exponential of minus 1 over h bar se of phi, with the action given by this object. Okay. So we have a ratio of two integrals. Okay. Now, the crucial point is that since the scalar free has no interaction, it describes an action which is quadratic in phi. So se phi. In fact, it's a quadratic form in phi because it involves two powers of phi. And since we are dealing with periodic boundary condition, assume so we have periodic boundary condition in this direction, but, and then we take the period to be infinity. Let's assume for simplicity that we have also periodic boundary condition here. Then you can integrate by part, and this is just integral d dx of phi of x, and then integrate by part, you get two derivatives acting to the right phi, for instance, so you get minus the scalar Laplacian plus m squared applied to phi point x, where you get a factor of 1/2, and delta is d mu d mu. That's this Laplacian operator. Okay. And so these are Gaussian integrals. Okay. And then I think you have seen Gaussian integrals already in the front-end math and already in some other lectures, because Gaussian integrals are everywhere in physics as well as in mathematics. And this is a quadratic form, and therefore you know, so this corresponds, if you want to, the expectation value of a random variable obeying some Gaussian probability distribution. It's equivalent. So this object can be viewed as an expectation value of a Gaussian, of a product of two Gaussian random variable obeying Gaussian statistics. So, equivalent to state that phi is a random variable obeying Gaussian statistics. Yeah. And then there is a famous theorem which states simply that then this object, the expectation value of a product of two variables, is just the inverse, the matrix element, or is just the matrix element of the inverse of the quadratic form. So it's something that I'm going to write minus nabla plus m squared. You have an you have a 1 over h bar, so you have an h bar here. And you take the matrix element between x, the point x1 and x2. So this object, in fact, is a kernel of a quadratic form. It's a differential operator. And this function is a kernel of the inverse. Kernel of the inverse of the operator minus delta plus m squared. Okay. Just a consequence of the theory of Gaussian integrals and statistics of Gaussian random variable. Okay.
Could you explain the nomenclature again? What do you call the kernel?
Pardon? Ah, the kernel is that. I think you have seen that in some in the front end, and it's explained in many books that you have reference to. If you have an operator, if you have an operator, a differential acting on function. Function on R, for instance. That's a simple case. So it means that to a given function phi, I associate a function O of phi. So phi is a function. O phi is another function. And O is a linear operator acting on the function. So it's a generalization of a matrix acting on vectors. And if this operator is called trace class, that's a technical definition, but it's mathematically reverse. It means that the value of the function O of phi at a given point x, it's given by the analog for functional operators of the sum of the matrix element of the matrix associated to the operator times the original vector. So it's just integral over dy, some function k of xy, phi of y. So that's it, you see. With k, some in general distribution. In simple case, it's a function. In a more complicated case, it's a distribution function, but with you know, Dirac delta functions, derivative of Dirac delta function. Oh, no. Okay. So this object K is called is a kernel of the operator O. So the kernel is the if for linear operator acting on function, the analog of the matrix element of the matrix representation of a linear operator in a given basis. Yes?
So in our discussions of this, instead of using that notion, we had used the notion of trying as a matrix inverse of trying to find the Green's function.
Yes.
And Green's functions are defined up to solutions of the homogeneous equation, right?
Yes.
So in our previous approach, in the canonical approach, we saw explicitly the Feynman choice, the Feynman propagator popping out in here.
I'm going to show that. For the moment, I've not solved, but I am going to explain why this comes from.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So this object is nothing but the kernel of the inverse of the operator minus lambda plus m squared. So let us call it h bar times a function g of x1, x2. G for Green function operator, because it's the analog of. So it's a green function of this operator. Okay. And so it's the kernel of the inverse of this operator. Therefore, it obeys a simple differential equation, which means that minus nabla plus m squared, where you take derivative to respect of x1, of g of x1, x2, is nothing but the kernel of the identity operator, which is a Dirac delta function. Okay. And of course, here I'm working in general d dimension. This is a Laplace operator with respect to the first variable. Okay. So now, of course, as you said, this is defined up to a solution of the homogeneous equation. But the solution of the homogeneous equation are just growing, are just exponentials. See?
Oh, because the
yeah.
Because we're in
the so solution of homogeneous equation equal exponential. Exponential of. And you can solve that easily, that exponent of the form exponential x times some unit vector u times m. So that, those are solutions that grows in one direction and decays in another direction. They grow. U plus direction, it's a positive U direction. Okay. But we started from defining this in periodic. We define in space-time so that the function stays bounded in periodic space-time. And then we take the period to infinity. You see? This means that, in fact, if you work a bit carefully, we want, this implies that we want that in the large, in the limit when the period goes to infinity, we want that the function g of x1, x2 is bounded at infinity. Okay? And so this excludes adding any of those solutions of the homogeneous solution. In fact, I'm going to show that they go to zero. Okay, so we just have to look at the solution of this equation, the same function, that decays at infinity. Okay, so. Oh. Yes?
Is there a analog of this for when you can you try to do can one try to do the calculation without going into Euclidean time because in
yes
case you don't
yeah have but that's a bit you have to be you just have to be more careful
okay.
About the boundary condition because this stating that the function decays at infinity is a boundary condition in Euclidean space time. if you work directly in Minkowski spacetime, then you have to set which boundary condition you are dealing with. It's spatial infinity and in future and in the past. So you have to deal with causality. And then, of course, that's what you've seen in QFT1. You may have different boundary conditions at future infinity and at past infinity. And depending on the condition you impose, you can get the advanced propagator, the retard propagator, the Feynman propagator, or any linear combination of those. So dealing with boundary condition in real time is of course possible, that's important. It depends on the physical problem you address, but it's a bit more delicate. So that's one of the reasons why I present the calculation in Euclidean spacetime. Here, there is only one. Only one sensible boundary condition. For periodic spacetime, of course. Okay. Periodic. Okay, so then the solution is just that you have to invert this equation. Well, that's a well-known equation, and you can do that in many, many times. But of course, the simplest way to construct the solution that you have seen already, I think, both in QFT1 and in statistical physics, is that you use the following fact. First, so we are looking for a function f of x1 and x2. Well, by translation invariance of the problem, it's clear that it's a function of x1 minus x2. By translation. By rotation invariance, it will be a function of the modulus of this vector. But I won't use that yet. Okay. And therefore, you can. Consider its Fourier transform. So you define g hat of k, which is integral over dx over rd of e I kx, these are vectors in d dimension, times g of x, plus or minus, I never remember. That's minus, that's my definition. Okay, and this equation becomes the Fourier transform of this, which is k squared. K is a vector. K is this k zero up to k e minus one. So it's a momentum, it's an impulsion vector. And the indices are indices because the indices of x are upper indices. That's covariance component is x mu. Okay, u. Okay. So the solution is the Fourier transform of minus nabla is just multiplication by k squared. Fourier transform of the m is m squared. Fourier transform of g of x is g of k, and the Fourier transform of a delta function is just one. And therefore, g hat of k is just one over k squared plus m squared. This k squared is, of course, K mu, sum over the K mu's. Hence, g hat of x is the inverse Fourier transform, so it's integral over dk, e dk, with normalization 2 pi to the power of d, e I, the vector k times x times 1 over k squared plus n squared. So that's Fourier transform of Lorentzian. And well, this is a function, so that's a green function associated to the operator minus delta plus n squared, where delta is a Laplacian. Okay, so now while you open your books of functions or any textbooks, or you ask Mathematica, since we are in, well, we are rather in the land of maples, any of your form, and you found, for instance, that you have a lot of explicit expressions. So, for instance, you have, that's written in the notes, 1 over 2 pi, 2 pi times the modulus of x divided by the mass, to the power 2 minus d divided by 2 times a second kind Bessel function of the second time of the modulus of x times the mass, where this is Bessel function. Okay. So this is the solution. This is the Green function. In Euclidean. And its rotation invariance. Okay. And now what are its properties? Let me just stress two very important properties of this object. First, what is its properties when x goes to infinity at large distance between the two points? Remember, x is x1 minus 2. So x is the vector x1 minus 2. What happens when the two points are very far apart? Well, you can either study a bit this integral representation. Let me this integral representation, so that's important. Or you can study the properties of the Bessel function, or you can just solve the original equation here, minus lambda plus n squared of g of x equal delta of x when x is large, and use the fact that the Laplacian is d squared over dr squared plus d minus 1 over r d of dr, and use the fact that if the distance is large, this term is negligible with respect to this one. And you found that g of x behaves as exponential minus the modulus of x divided by heavy. So there is exponential decay. And as I said here, the Green function turns out to decay at infinity, to go to zero. Okay? And M is related to the typical length scale at which is decay. And in statistical mechanics, you have seen that where you have such functions, M is just the inverse of zeta, where zeta is the correlation, what's called the correlation length. It measures the typical distance at which the quantum fields are correlated. Okay. Of the quantum field. Okay, so that's the first point, large distance. Now, small distance. And things are going to be interesting. Small distance, what's happening when x goes to zero? When you have two points but they come very close from each other. Well, you can do the argument by stating simply that if x is very small, this oscillates very slowly. So the important contribution from the large k, and if k is large, you can neglect the mass term. So small distance, mass term m is irrelevant. So you can forget about it and study this integral without an m. But then you can just rescale k with x, do some dimensional analysis, and you see that at large distance, g of x behaves like the modulus of x to some power, and the power is simply 2 minus d. And you have some coefficient in front of it. So at small distance, you see that this becomes singular as soon as d is larger than 2. So this is divergent. If the dimension of space-time is larger than 2. Okay? And if you walk a bit more, and consider what's happening at d equal 2. At d equal 2, you have a d2k over k squared, which is still divergent, but that's a logarithmic divergence. So you work a little bit, and I can could present you the calculation, but that's not important. What you get is that this behaves like a log. The modulus of the distance divided by m with a coefficient, and the coefficient is 1 over 2 pi, I think. And there is a minus 1 because, of course, small and small x, the log is negative, but this has to be positive. So, so it's 1 over x squared, I think. With a non-zero probability that I've used. So you see that this object is singular. This object is singular at small distance as long as the dimension is larger, of space-time is larger or equal to 2. And that's what makes quantum field theory very different from quantum mechanics. Because in quantum mechanics, you have only one time. And in quantum mechanics, of course, you have a position of the particles, but the position doesn't play the same role that the position in space-time, in quantum field theory, as I think Dan and Gong explained to you. The position in quantum mechanics is rather the analog of the field phi, because Q is an operator in quantum mechanics, and phi is a field operator. OK. So quantum field theory is singular at short distance, short time. And that's the first appearance of what's called ultraviolet singularities that I mentioned, I think, in the first lecture. OK. And that makes life interesting, because a lot of properties of the quantum field theory comes or can be derived from this. So that's very important. Okay, well, I promised you a pause, so it's a good time to do the pause. And let's resume in 5 minutes, sharp. Yes?
So we're using this method to find the inverse operator. We had to assume the operator was a trace class.
Yes.
But one thing you can go through this whole process using generating function.
Yes.
In that case, I don't have to assume anything about the trace, like operator.
Yes.
Trace
yes. Yes. You
so
have.
Like
I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about generating function later when doing perturbation theory.
Okay.
But all this is more or less the same, because generating functions means also solving this kind of equation, which are called the Schwinger-Dyson equation for the free field. So everything is the same.
So like, if I use a generated one, just going there, I don't have to assume anything about my operator being of trace class, or still is that assumption still?
Well, the calculation I've been doing is for this very specific operator, which is trace class. That's a classical result of functional analysis.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know what is in general, because but in general, if you have something where the propagator cannot be well defined because you have mathematical problem, it means that the functional integral has problems too, and probably the quantum theory.
Okay.
Probably. I prefer not to say. Okay. Let me go back, and I'm going just to show you some pictures that are computer generated. Yes.
So the correlation functions. At large distance and small distance,
yes.
Is a decaying exponential and then an algebraically decaying function.
Yes.
So this is quite reminiscent of condensed matter of like order phases.
Oh yes, of course. Yes.
Could you comment something about
that? Well, I can just comment at that stage that by doing path integral or functional integral in Euclidean space-time, in fact, I'm doing statistical mechanics because I'm dealing with a random field. So, in fact, the same calculation, I think you have met them, and occurs in condensed matter. Yeah. Okay. So, what I want to show you is just explain to you a bit of not the physical, but what those singularity at short distance I discussed in the language of functional integral. So remember, I argue that doing a functional integral over a Gaussian field is the same thing as considering the field as a random variable, an extended random variable. So the rule, each configuration of a field is a random variable. And we are doing probability theory in a complicated probability space, which is some space of random field configuration. And when you do probability and you have a configuration space with some probability, you can take sample of them and see what is the typical configuration in the probability distribution of objects you are considering. And that's easy to do with a free field. So I'm going just to give some results. So I take a free field configuration in the functional integral. It's called Gaussian free field in mass because the field is Gaussian. And I'm dealing, of course, with a configuration in Euclidean space-time, and now I'm dealing with a periodic Euclidean space-time. And well, first, you may argue that one-dimensional quantum field theory is just like quantum mechanics. So what are the random field configuration of the field in a one-dimensional quantum mechanics? Those are just the histories of the particle, the trajectory of the particle that you sum up in the path integral. And in one dimension, as I argue, there are Brownian motion corresponding to what mathematicians call the Wiener process. So they are random walks. And those are typical configuration of a random walk evolving in this Euclidean time direction. So this is the position, this is the time, and we have random walks conditioned to start from a given point and to end up at the same point. And those are typical configuration of random walks, and you know that random walks are very wild objects, but they are continuous functions. Their derivative is infinite almost everywhere. But they are continuous functions. So these are typical random walls that you have met or that you will meet everywhere in statistical physics. Okay.
Good question.
Yes?
The horizontal axis is like Euclidean time here?
Yeah, that's Euclidean time. So imagine, for instance, imagine that you have a particle submitted to a Brownian noise that fluctuates in...
That this is more like zero-dimensional, right?
No, it's one-dimensional. This is the position of the particle, and this is the time.
In a field theory, in one dimension, you have one value of the field at every point.
That's zero-dimensional. That's zero space-dimensional field theory.
Right.
Okay, so zero dimension, zero space dimension, one time dimension is quantum mechanics. And the degree of freedom of the field is the position of the particle. So position of a non-relative particle is just a field. It's just a quantum field because it's an operator. Okay. Okay, so these are typical quantum fields. Now, if you go to two dimension, of course, the field can vary in two directions. The time direction here, and the space dimension here. And it takes a value, which is a real number. So the third vertical dimension is a value of the field. So this is a three-dimensional plot. And of course, in order to make a nice figure and calculation, I discretize space-time. So here, think about that. I have used a periodic boundary condition for my Euclidean space-time. And in addition, I came back to what I explained last lecture. I discretized space and time so that it's a lattice by 64 by 64. And so you see that it's an object that's a typical sample. So it's very irregular. It's a random field. So it's irregular already. Now, what's interesting is to see, can we say something about how do you see the behavior of the propagator at short distance in space-time from such kind of studies, numerical studies? Well, that's easy. You just have to refine the mesh of space-time so that you go to smaller and smaller distance. So I take the same statistics with the same action, but I take a finer lattice. Okay, this is a finer lattice. There are four times more cells. So the mesh is twice smaller. And you see the object fluctuates more. Double the spacing. It becomes quite spiky. Double it again. Very spiky, and then I stopped there because then my mathematical and my computer, my small computer, was starting to be, well, the graphics started to be tedious. But you see that the finer the mesh, the more spiky it is. That's in two dimensions. And in fact, in the limit of an infinite mesh, this object becomes infinitely spiky, which means that in the language of mathematics, this is not a function anymore. It's a distribution, in the sense of a mathematician, if you want, a generalization of a sum of delta functions, of Dirac delta functions. But with Dirac delta functions, an object worse than Dirac delta function everywhere. So it's nowhere a function. But still, it's a well-defined mathematical object, which is called a distribution in the space of Gaussian fields. Okay.
So as I go to small distance physically, that means I'm observing more of the vacuum state of my system behavior.
Yes, so you are exciting in the language of canonical quantization, you are exciting more and more particles. So you see more and more excited states of the field. Because
when
you go
to small distance?
Yeah, because small distance is small time, remember, too. And small times means high energy. That's Heisenberg principle. Or it's delta x times delta p is h bar. So small distance means high impulsions. So more energetic particles.
I would think that when I zoom out, I'm seeing more particles than is Because if I have the idea that fields or like the bumps of the fields are particles, then when I'm zoom out, I'm seeing more particles. When I'm going in, I should just be seeing the grounds.
No, but you see more and more virtual particles. Remember?
When
you zoom in.
When I zoom in.
Remember, in quantum theory, you have virtual states. You have virtual particles that pops out of the vacuum. Well, that's a picture I never really understood. They pop out and disappear, et cetera, et cetera. And the finer you zoom, the more you see of them. Because you are zooming at small distance, so you see more energetic particles. So the one virtual particles that you don't see at large distance, you start to see them at short distance. And there are more and more of them.
Right. So based on this picture, that means that vacuum state is chaotic, based on this picture. Because
well, the quantum states of a quantum theory is a very, very interesting object. It's much wilder than in quantum mechanics, yes. But it's still a vacuum. It's perfectly stable, no energy. You have quantum fluctuation, but you cannot observe them unless you probe space-time with gravitation. Okay. Okay, so now in three dimensions, so that's in two dimensions. Let's do the same thing in three dimensions. So in three dimensions, of course, I take a two-dimensional slice of a Gaussian field in three dimensions, and I represent it in the same way. Well, that's for a small lattice. Finer lattice, and do I have the, again one. So it's, you see the same effect, it's spiky. And if you measure the fluctuations, in fact, it's much more spiky than in two dimensions. So in two dimensions, I wouldn't like to sit on a Gaussian free field, but I would prefer two dimensions than three dimensions, definitely. Okay. And that's because and that's related to the fact that the Gaussian, the propagator in two dimensions diverges at like a log of the distance. While in three dimensions, it diverges like 1/1 the distance. So it diverges more, which means that the fluctuations are more important in three than in two dimensions. Okay, so that's in some sense a way to get a physical picture of this kind of quantum fluctuation of the field, of course, in Euclidean space-time. So there is something, you know, deep and physical. Besides these divergences. These divergences are not just some mathematical artifacts. Okay, so let me stop there and resume the lecture. How much time do I have? Okay, so now let me briefly go back to from Euclidean. Minkowski. Real time for the propagator. And I think that's something that you have already studied, discussed a bit in QFT1 and discussed in some tutorial. So now we expect, at the moment, it's not a proof, we expect that going from this object, G Euclidean of x, I expect that going back, I'm going to get the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of the product of two field operators. So I expect that I'm going to get the Feynman propagator, well, let's call it x and zero, which is a GF of x and zero, which is the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of two operator, one field operator from zero, one at point x, time ordered, because remember, path integral automatically order in time the operator. It does the job. No need to care about ordering operator. Path integral does the job. Which is the Feynman propagator. If you get don't time order, then you get other propagators. other combination of advanced and retarded properties. Okay, so first we have to check that. Check. Yes, that this is true. And so we start from Euclidean spacetime. So in Euclidean spacetime, we have two dimensions. You have a dimension that I can call x naught. Well, I'm using tau in my notes, but maybe it's better to use x naught. And you have a space dimension, which I'm going to call x. Okay, so x Euclidean, so the x Euclidean space-time vector is, well, it should be x naught. X naught, x. This is an Euclidean. Vector. Okay. And the propagator is g of x Euclidean is integral dk over 2 pi to the power d. Well, this is a, let me call it a capital K. That's a capital K Euclidean exponential minus exponential pi k Euclidean times x Euclidean. Divided by k Euclidean squared plus m squared, where my Euclidean momenta is just a component, a time component and a space component. So that's position. Momentum, the conjugate momentum, conjugate variable. Okay, and I want to go from this to Minkowski, where I have T0 time and x. So I have time and x. And you know that in order to do that, you have to do a Vick rotation. Because remember, this is this picture we got in relativistic mechanics. This was x naught equal time Euclidean, which I denoted tau. So this is Euclidean. This is Minkowski. This is Euclidean. So if you are somewhere here, and we want to go back to real time, we have to do a Vick rotation. Which means that we have to replace x naught by I t. Remember, this is x. Turn this picture. Rotate by one, you have T Euclidean. In real time, so you rotate it by a factor pi, a phase plus pi over two. Okay, so I have a function of x naught and x, and I see what's happening, what are the properties of this function if I replace x naught by it. Well, use this integral representation. If I, so let's write ei kexe. This is just, of course, exponential I x naught k naught plus x times k. And this is x naught. If I rotate t, x naught get a phase in particular, and therefore this is no more a complex number. You see? It has a real component, and I integrate over k naught. Therefore, I have an integral of a growing exponential in one direction. So that's bad, a priori. But remember that this integral, dke, is integral over dk naught times integral over dk. And think about what's going on in the k naught space. I integrate here from minus infinity to plus infinity. Originally, I have x naught, which is there. So I have it's better to write too quick. So here, I'm here. Well, this is yellow. So this is T Euclidean, and I want to go to a real spacetime. So Minkowski is Minkowski is red. Euclidean is yellow. Okay. Well, I'd like to define this integral so that this remains a phase. So in order for this to remain a phase, if I rotate x naught by pi, by an angle pi over 2, I like to rotate the k integral by an angle minus pi over 2. So that the phase in x is compensated by the phase here. I'm allowed to do that, of course, because this is an integral over a contour of a function which is analytic in k0. So I can deform the contour. And here I am using the fact that this function is analytic. And so analyticity of the correlation function in momentum space is something very, very important. Okay. And in fact, analyticity comes from locality in quantum field theory, as we'll see. Yes?
So why can you rotate the opposite direction, like instead of minus pi over 2, you rotate pi over 2 to the k?
That's in order to have this keeping. I want to keep this real.
Yeah, you want to keep the phase unchanged. So what about you just change the phase 108 degree to take the opposite direction?
100?
Yeah, you rotate the direct opposite direction.
You mean you want to rotate it in this way?
Yes, we only depend on k0 square, I think.
No, that's not good, because if k0, if x0 is imaginary,
yeah,
this is exponential minus k0.
Yes.
So if I change k0 in minus k0, it's still an exponential. Bad. That's the only choice possible, only possible choice. If I process by small steps, you know, you can imagine that first I rotate here.
Sir, I don't understand.
By a small angle, then I have to rotate my contour by this small angle.
Yes, what I'm saying is that after the weak rotation, the phase is also the oscillating phase, the complex phase.
What?
There's a phase, e to the ikx.
Yeah, there's still a phase, but it's a phase.
Yes,
it's an oscillatory function.
So why can we take the opposite of the phase to the e to the
what can we make take what?
Opposite of the phase. Rotate one.
No, because if I rotate in the other direction, the two phases adds up. So you still get a growing exponential in one of the directions.
Sorry, it is a phase. So I think it makes no difference. We take it.
No, it makes a difference. That's the only choice. If you rotate E,
not the real.
If you rotate E by an angle theta, you have to rotate here by an angle minus theta in order for this to become real. It's a math.
Okay, maybe we can discuss later.
It's a trick, but it's the only trick that works, deforming the contour while you move X naught in the convex plane.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, which means that, this means simply the following thing. When I change X naught in IT, I have simultaneously to change k naught into minus I, and let me call this omega, because it's going to be a change of. Okay, so here I add k naught. And here I have omega. So change of, I make a big rotation so that X naught is imaginary. And then the imaginary part is, I call it T. And I rotate K0 in the opposite direction so that it's imaginary. And minus the imaginary part of K0, I call it omega. It's a pulsation. And we'll see what's going on. Okay, so that's just a choice of change of denomination. So when I'm doing that, of course, T and omega are real here and here. Okay, well, what's going on? Of course, this becomes, when I do the weak rotation, exponential I, T times omega plus x down k. The integral becomes, I make a change of variable, so it becomes minus I integral d omega integral d k. Okay? And then, of course, what's important, what becomes this? This becomes which is 1 over k0 squared plus k squared plus m squared becomes 1 over minus omega squared plus k squared plus m squared. You start to see the propagator in real space. But beware. In this k0 omega plane, this object, you see, this denominator has zeros. So the inverse of the propagator has poles at k0 equal minus the square root of this. So that's plus or minus I square root of k squared plus m squared. This is the front. So, I already lost my. It is. So they have a pole here and here. And when I deform my contour, my weak rotation, you have to be careful about what how do you deal with the poles? But you know what it is because you rotate it. So, so your contour becomes, becomes this. Because you turn them so that the contour is to the right of this pole and to the left of this pole. So, this is this prescription. This prescription is just the epsilon prescription of Feynman. So, in fact, this is minus omega squared plus k squared minus plus m squared minus I epsilon plus, where epsilon plus is a positive integral. It corresponds to this perception. That's it. And therefore, what you get is that the propagator of T and X is, what is it? So the final, that's minus I. So that's integral d omega, integral dk, exponential I omega t plus k x. You get a minus I factor here. You get a minus omega squared, so you get I divided by omega squared minus k squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. Okay. And remember that omega is just the weak rotated contour of k0. So omega, omega is k0 if you consider a vector which is omega k. Okay, so when k are just the component k mu of this vector k. Okay. And usually one considers the vector, the upper vector k, where k mu equals the energy and k. But going, so E is k zero. But since we have that our metric in Minkowski space is minus plus plus plus, you get minus et plus kx, which is the usual way it is written. But you see that with this, this is minus on here. And and with this choice of notation, this is not nothing but the Feynman propagator. And it's, so we have recovered what we expected.
So just for clarification, is the deformation is still happening in the Euclidean space-time?
I start from Euclidean space-time, and then I make a weak rotation in both t and k. And I recover the Feynman propagator. So what it means is that the Feynman propagator is just the analytic continuation to Minkowski spacetime of the propagator in Euclidean spacetime. So you may consider the propagator as a function which is analytic in a time variable which is complex. And restricted to Euclidean spacetime, this is this propagator. Restricted to Euclidean spacetime, it is the Feynman propagator. So those are a unique object if you consider those objects as defined in a space of complex times and complex momenta.
So when I'm, it's just confusing that that K naught by setting equals to you setting energy to be imaginary.
Yes.
Like in the Euclidean space-time. Still.
Yeah. Yeah. If I have a, if you want, if you have an Euclidean energy and you make it imaginary, it means that you have a real energy in physical space-time.
Okay.
It's just it's a bit of gymnastic. You have get too used to it. But it's a gymnastic which is very useful and to, which is used by you know by theoretical physicists very often.
I feel like when we have quantum field theory to go to statistic, we just have to do regurgitation.
Yes.
To go to statistic to quantum field theory, you have to do regurgitation and imaginary energy.
No, but that's the same. That's the same. It's an anti-Vick rotation. It's just a redefinition. The object you call something in Euclidean, you call it something else in. Because the physics is different, but that's it's just a redefinition of the field. Analytic continuation and relabeling of what you are considering depending on the, what you are doing in physics. So in physics, in real time, you are dealing with energy and momenta. Okay. Okay. Well, I think I will end up here. So basically, the Feynman propagator is the analytic continuation to real Minkowski space, to Minkowski spacetime of the propagator of the Euclidean propagator, which has this simple structure I wrote here. So the you know the conclusion, the moral of this morality of this calculation is that everything works fine for this very simple quantum field theory. As in quantum mechanics, or for instance, for an harmonic oscillator. So you can rely on functional integrals in order to do calculation in quantum field theory. That's one tool that you can use, and which is sometimes very convenient. Sometimes it's still used, but it's there. So we get another equivalent formulation of quantum physics, convenient for some calculation. Okay, let me end there. And tomorrow I will derive very quickly, but you have seen that already, how you get the Vick theorem. That's a very important theorem. Then I'll start to discuss the interacting theory. Of course, because what we need to do is to construct a theory with interaction. The quantum free field is very illustrating. It's important when you deal with, for instance, quantizing the electromagnetic field, because the electromagnetic field, if you have no electrons, no matter, it's a free field, it doesn't interact. But of course, real in the universe, you have interactions. Okay, thank you.